Trish and Rob McGregor welcome you to a place where all kinds of phenomena flourish. Here we meet authors, researchers, and investigators of the mysterious, the strange, and of the inexplicable anomalies that surround us. Step out of the everyday world and take a journey into the mystical underground.
Start recording in 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Mystical Underground. Thank you for joining us. This is Trish McGregor and
Rob McGregor.
And our tech magician, John Posey. He's the disembodied voice. You can go to themysticalunderground.com where we make regular blog posts and where you can find out about our books. Among them are The Seven Secrets of Synchronicity, Sensing the Future, The Secrets of Spirit Communication, Aliens in the Backyard. Our latest book is called Mind-Blowing Synchronicities, The Latest Science, Stories, and Research. Trish's most recent novel is Silent Thunder, and Rob's is called Tulpas, a story of mysterious beings created through deep meditation. If you're watching us on YouTube, we would appreciate it if you would take a second to click the like, subscribe, and notification button so you never miss an episode. If you prefer to listen to the show, it's available wherever you listen to podcasts. Please subscribe there.
Okay, our guest today is Paulina Rudd. She is a doctoral candidate in art history at Moscow University and holds a master's degree in international relations. She is an art curator, lecturer, and co-founder of a support group for human rights defenders, environmental activists, and communities affected by systematic violence. Her work bridges academic research, therapeutic practice, and symbolic systems such as theosophy, Nordic runes, and Hindu astrology. Trained in mental health and suicide risk prevention, she integrates spiritual and psychological tools to support personal transformation. She helps individuals uncover hidden patterns and realign with their inner path. She is the author of The Cosmic Game of Snakes and Arrows, an oracle for Mapping Your Destiny. It's a modern guidebook related to a game that dates back to 10th century India. She shows us in the book how to use the game as an intuitive psychological tool for self-discovery and a guide to higher consciousness. Welcome, Paulina.
Good to have you.
Thank you for inviting me, and thank you for this warm introduction. Really happy.
And tell us, like we were just talking about, tell us where you're living now. I found that interesting.
So true, yeah.
So you're living in Argentina.
Yeah, right now I'm living in Argentina, but it's just for 2 weeks because okay. I used to live in Mexico City for about 8 years. So actually I wrote this book in Mexico City, and yeah, but right now our last changes in my life. And yeah, I'm in Argentina right now in Buenos Aires.
So
now,
you're fluent in three languages, Spanish, Russian, English.
Yeah, and that too in French as well. So,
wow.
Yeah.
For you.
So this change in your life now from Mexico City to Argentina, did that come up in the game when you're playing it? Or is that, did you see it there?
I think that the game learned and restored my intuition. So I didn't see it in the game. I didn't see it coming, but yeah. I saw it coming with my intuition. So when I finished the book, I felt that I have one rule that I cannot write more than 1,000 pages in one laptop. And I feel the same about the space. Like the house where I'm living, and I felt that maybe creatively I got everything that I could from this space. And that's why I thought that, well, okay, I gave lots of things to this space. I got lots of things from this physical surrounding, and right now I have to move.
Wow. Rob, maybe that's what we should do. We lived in the same space for 25 years, so it's like,
oh my God.
So tell us about the Cosmic Game of Snakes and Arrows. It's a board game, right? And it's there are pieces with it, and Tell us about how you got involved with it and about the game.
So briefly speaking about this game, I think everybody knows this game, as we mentioned in our introduction part, that everybody knows it like shooting letters, and lots of people in their childhood with their parents inside a family reunion have ever played this game. So you just throw a die and you follow the die going up with letters and going down with shoots. And in my case, in this book and this speech, it's all about snakes that are leading you down. So initially, this game was created in between India and Tibet. And then this game started to be in between the British Empire and Indian culture. And the most interesting thing here that we are not speaking about colonization, because we can say that colonization took away all the knowledge, all the ancient knowledge, and started to commercialize this game. But it was not like that, because the dynamics of this game was brought from Italy, from the game, the goose game. We also know this game, the dynamic where you're also throw a die and you're moving across the field. And then the knowledge of each square was brought from Indian culture, from Hindu culture. So I really love to say that it is built in the intersection of cultures. There was no violence of colonization, that they appropriated, they conquered this knowledge. So that's why I feel that that's pretty beautiful. So the dynamics of this game, we really know. The thing that we don't know, that it comes from India, and each square used to have a very profound meaning. On the one hand, it is a psychological meaning, because first layers or first arrows of, well, arrows and also first experiences, first squares of this game are connected to more psychological experiences, lineage experiences. And then while you go up, 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 it becomes more transcendental, more spiritual game. And there is an interesting thing about these interpretations, because these interpretations were lost since at first they were sounds. So people, while they were playing, and once they landed on a square, they pronounced a sound and they communicated the interpretation of the square with a sound, which to me seems more true, because we are conditioned by language, and not every single time we can transmit the knowledge, the everything that we want to see verbally, because it has their own limits. But with this vibration, we can be more precise to say that, because every single time when I tell this story, Octavio Paz comes to my mind, because while he was writing his book, human beings are linguistic monkeys and they are conditioned by their language, and we cannot perceive anything without naming it. I think it's so true here. But we had to interpret it verbally, but it used to be in a sound, and these vibrations communicating the knowledge of each square.
Okay, if the game had a voice, okay, just like what you're talking about, what would it say to humanity right now?
That compassion is more important than service, because lots of people, when they come to play this game, they start to ask about how it can be useful. And lots of people want to know, how can I be useful? Because the existence is meant to be a function. And lots of people are thinking about themselves as a function. How can I apply myself to that? And if I don't have any function, do I have the right to exist? And every single time they're trying to figure out, what is my usage? What is my utility? And sometimes it might be a prism. And there is an interesting thing, because on the board, we can see two arrows, one arrow of a service, and it leads you three rows up. And the arrow of compassion, it leads you to the last row. So it makes you fly. And that's the most important thing, because we have to find this compassion towards people. And it's easy to say that I like this person and I feel that I can experiment compassion towards people that I like, towards people with whom I coincide, right? But it's difficult to experiment I meant with your heart, not rationally, compassion towards people with whom I don't coincide in values, in my emotions and actions, etc. So I really would love to communicate the thought that service is important, but it's not that important as compassion. And in order to find this compassion towards the people who we don't like, we have to dive deeper into our shadow part, which should be reflected in our shadow part with that. And speaking about compassion, obviously, I think every single time about this history example of Mehmet Ali Agca, who intended to kill Pope John Paul II. And there is a famous photo when the Pope comes to visit him, Mehmet Ali Agca, and he starts to communicate with him, asking and trying to understand what were his motives. And I think it's pretty difficult inside to see a person who wanted to kill you. And also, I remember you mentioned our NGO. My partner and I, we founded an NGO where we provide free psychosocial support for activists, for people who support the humanity in different ways, right? And I remember we have a story of one activist, and she's fighting for the rights of people who are in prison. And she's a psychologist, and once she had to give a therapeutic session to a person who ordered to kill her grandfather. So, and I think that in this case, it was a great situation where she could practice this compassion truly, not like only rationally, but try to find this solid soil inside in order to assist this person.
Huh. Where is she from?
She's from Mexico.
From Mexico. Huh. Okay. Yeah. So a little bit ago, a few minutes ago, we had on the screen the picture of the very early version of the game. And I believe it was originally called Guan Kapor. There's the picture again. Is that how it's pronounced? That the game's original name, Guan Kapor. So it's like, which means the game of knowledge. So it's like a spiritual board game is what has developed. I'm wondering in that regard why the game begins with a player on the cosmic consciousness square, which I thought that's the goal, isn't that? But why is the player start there? Can you maybe talk a bit about the game and how it operates? Yeah,
that's the curious question. It might be pronounced in different ways, and one of the ways to pronounce it is Jian Chao Par, which correctly you mentioned that it is translated from Sanskrit, like the game of knowledge. And we start playing this game on the square of cosmic consciousness because we are supposed to be born from the void, from nothing, where we don't have any molecules. We are dispersed in the universe. So with our intention to be born, because it is considered that our spirit chooses our soul, then our soul chooses the lineage, how we're going to be provoked with our karma experience. And then with all this will, we should incarnate, right? So we have to find this material presence in order to be born. And then obviously we have to come back to that state of the void, of this dispersed state in the universe. So that's why we have to be born from this square and we have to come back. And despite the fact that this board has 72 squares, it seems like we have to go to the final point, but it's not. And I really like this point because every single time in this capitalistic world, we tend to arrive to the aim, to the goal, to the final destination, right? Because we think that every single thing that we are doing in our life should have a purpose, should have this target, why we are going there. And I truly like the fact that we are not going to the final point, to the 72nd square, and we have to go on to 68, so that to be a rebel a little bit to holistic logic as well.
Huh.
Interesting. What motivated you to get into this, writing a book about the game?
Initially, I found this game in the midst of turmoil in my life because when I was 17, my boyfriend died. So it was really difficult for me because it was not something common to go to a psychologist or to find any spiritual practice in Russia at that time. You were supposed to go through all these internal turmoils by yourself. So at certain moment in my life, I had to look for my own answers. And apart all the books that I read, and mostly they were books from ancient Eastern philosophies, in between all these books, I found this game. So this game really helped me to figure out, at first, my relationship with death. So that was pretty intricate for me, pretty difficult to figure out because it implied questioning the concepts of justice and injustice, why that happened. Yeah, I think that was the starting point. And then I understood that as well, while I was using this game board, I started to do my research on runes and on tarot cards. And to say the truth, I abused a little bit from these oracles because I was not secure inside. I didn't have any answers inside. And every single day I used an oracle, I don't know, a tarot card, a rune, etc. So I atrophied my intuition completely because it was easy. You just draw one card, you just draw one rune, and you have an answer to your question, right? So I atrophied completely my intuition. And with this game, it's not that easy because obviously you can throw a die and very quickly say, okay, I need only one square. But basically you have to spend for about two to three to four hours in order to have all these answers that you want to have. And it helped me to restore my intuition. So that's why I wanted to share with people something that's helped me in between these turmoils and insecurities, because right now I see that the world is living this poly crisis everywhere. And while we're working with our NGO, we see that. And when the world is trembling, I think that we have to start questioning, and we should not sacrifice our freedom and our decisions for correct decisions, for these securities that firm right hand is offering us. And to do so, we have to find this resilience in chaos. And I think that while we are questioning and while we are developing our critical thinking, we can find this resilience. And for me, it was this game that trained me to question and not to be afraid of uncertainties, because every single time while you throw in a die, you face and encounter these uncertainties, and you train this leap into the void while you're throwing this die. And the thing that you can really see is that I'm rehearsing. I'm not making the decision. I'm rehearsing. I'm seeing the potential of this decision. And that internally makes me rehearse it and maybe not to have so much fear while I'm making this decision. So for me, it is the tool of encountering uncertainties. And right now, I think that as a humanity, we're going to face a lot of them.
Maybe we need to make sure the leaders in the world have this game. Okay, guys, down to it.
they would go down the snake, I'm afraid.
Yeah, right.
Paulina, you said you wrote in your book that when you started getting into the game seriously, you kept that happened to you. You kept going down the snake and into the darkness over and over. And but you learned something from that. Can you talk a bit about that?
Well, I have a question first. I'm just curious about something. So in Russia, you don't have access to any psychiatrists or psychics.
Right now we have access because it's a kind of a fashionable tendency, and you have to develop yourself and to know more. And there are lots of platforms where you can find your psychologist, where you can find your psychiatrist if it is necessary. So I know it's not a problem, but when I was 17, like almost 20 years ago, that was pretty difficult to speak about that. For example, my mom never came up to me saying that, Polina, maybe we have to consult like a psychotherapist or somebody so that to handle your internal issues, because my mom, obviously, she also didn't know how to behave, how to support me. She tried to do her best, but there was no question. We even didn't think about that that's possible to go to a person who specializes in all these topics, right? So,
so now it's freer.
Yeah, right now it's everywhere, and you can talk, you can speak about that. There are lots of therapists, integral therapists, psychotherapists, I don't know, archetypal therapists, lots of them. And coming back to your question, Rob, about snakes, that's interesting because snakes in this game tend to be demonized. And lots of people are saying, oh my God, one more time, snake, one more time, snake. Is there anything wrong with me? And it's not about that. It's about saying I shouldn't demonize my darkness as well, because I can find lots of jewels over there, darkness or shadow parts. And while we're speaking about darkness, I love to say that the higher the tree is, the bigger the darkness, the bigger their shadow. Because if we start to contemplate the nature, we see that the higher the tree, the shadow wouldn't disappear. It would never disappear. So the thing here is not to be afraid of these snakes, not to demonize them and welcoming them, because you will also have ups and downs in your life. So saying that, okay, right now that's my period of crisis. What I'm going to do there? And how not to be afraid of snakes, of crisis, is to elaborate your tools. Every single crisis, I have one more new tool. And that's why it makes me resilient, because I'm not afraid of crisis, because I know that I have the knowledge or the tools how to come out of that, right? So to use each crisis, to benefit from each crisis, thinking about that's my moment to find one more tool, like in Harry Potter, I don't know, one more strength of doing that, of coming out of this crisis, of finding another facet. But as I mentioned, exploring, researching our dark part, it's necessary in order to experiment compassion. Because if I'm the whitest of the whitest, it's almost impossible to feel compassion, because I'm going to put myself on the top of the hierarchy saying that I'm better. And this spiritual ego, that I'm very spiritual and I'm better. And I really like the quote that the most dangerous man is the man who understood what is the white side, what is the correct things in this life. And this man starts to distribute it everywhere, to deliver it to every single person. And that's the most dangerous man, because of this, there is no the truth, right? There are lots of things that may work for this or that person, and they are different. So yeah, the idea here is to enjoy the snakes. I know that it hurts, but there are lots of experiences and facets that you can find in these snakes.
Hey, okay, you speak.
I'm sorry, Trish. Just real quick, kind of wrapping back around. And what I found very interesting, I think what I understood was that you were saying that the board game is kind of a practice. It's a model for practicing how to deal. I'm probably adding this on top of it, but how to deal with decisions in life and that kind of thing. And definitely I've heard some folks talk over the last year or so about that that our dreams are actually practice on how to deal with things in the real world. Is that, you know, when we're asleep, we are our, you know, it, that that's what we do on those down cycles, is a lot of scenarios are thrown at you, and how do you learn? It's an opportunity to learn how to deal with something that you potentially haven't had to deal with yet. Does that make any sense at all as far as what you were talking about with the game? But
yeah. You brought a jewel this conversation, because there is a psychologist whose name is Donald Winnicott, and he spoke about game as a potential space, right? Or we need this potential space where we can suppose what's going to happen, and that's why I rehearse it. And while we are speaking about trauma or very uncomfortable internal experiences, sometimes it's almost impossible to get closer from the very first game or from the very first therapy. And you have to create a very safe space, saying that that's a game, and potentially we can speak about that. Or if we take, for example, some scenarios of making decisions in the future, let's suppose, and this phrase, let's suppose, let's play, just, it's not that serious. It doesn't sound that serious. And trauma and difficult decisions, they're very serious. They take us into a very dramatic place. And what the game does, creating this potential space, supposedly, it just gets out this seriousness that we don't need while we are actually making difficult decisions or while we are rehearsing different scenarios of creating our path.
Yeah, and I think that's the I think that's the word, rehearsal. That's the point, right? Rehearsal.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Exactly.
You often speak of archetypes as silent puppeteers. Can you explain that?
All our history, like what we consume, what we have been consuming, including religion, books, even cartoons, for example, they are archetypes that are being shown, they are being transmitted to our consciousness. And sometimes we even don't get what kind of archetype I consumed since my childhood. So that's why I start to behave from this archetype unconsciously. And the idea is to find all these archetypes, the roots of this archetype, and to see. Sometimes when I give therapies weekly, people are saying, oh my God, you're a witch. You predicted this, this, and that. And it's not because I'm a witch or I'm a fortune teller or anything like about this. But I see the scenario of this or that archetype. I know that after assisting to lots of people, how this archetype behaves. And that's why I cannot predict things, but I can see how this archetype tend to behave. Mm-hmm. And that's why when a person understands that, okay, mostly I have these 10 archetypes, mostly I have these 5 archetypes, and I know the tendency of these archetypes, it gives me the reins, because it is said that while I'm unconscious of these archetypes, they have the reins of my behavior. But once I'm conscious, I know how to take this archetype from its shadow part to its light part, to this strength part, to say that. So that's why I truly believe that that's very important, because if we start to analyze marketing uses lots of archetypes and all these manipulations where we can be trapped. And if you understand that, okay, they are trying to push, they are trying to press my weak side or my weak point, because I know that my mentality comes from scarcity, for example, right? And marketing is based on scarcity mentality. Every single time we are late for something, we have to buy this, this, and that. So it also, the knowledge of that not only helps to understand yourself and your weak side and strong sides, but also to understand how to be more attentive in your relationship with the outer world, not only with certain people, but also with the society and all the mechanisms that the system offers us.
You've studied Jung. Okay. I could tell. Yeah.
So what happens, though, when people become obsessed with this game, that they do it over and over and they spend hours and days? Does it become possibly a dangerous preoccupation? Like, I'm sure John knows about Dungeons and Dragons. I think he's played that. And that's one of the things that's said about Dungeons and Dragons. But would that be something parallel with this game? Could you get too involved in it? Like yourself?
No. She's not involved. She created it.
I didn't want to create any addiction mechanism, no?
Rehearsal.
So I hope that I didn't create any addiction mechanism for people for creating more dependency, because we have lots of things that we can be dependent on. But it may happen. There are people who are more inclined to be dependent on everything. On, I don't know, we are speaking about coffee, drugs, alcohol, games, whatever. Anything might be a point of dependency, right? Or anything. So the idea is to be free from everything. So not to be attached to that, knowing that, okay, right now I have games and assistant of attending my insecurities or for answering my questions, but I can live without that. And that's very important to take into account, because even if we speak about shamans, for example, lots of shamans have the altar, you know, which is full of things, amulets, objects, but do they truly need it? Or it's all about the power that I give to the object. So I think that it's very important to take into consideration and every single time remember to yourself that the objects, they have power on me only when I give this power to these objects. And in this case, I can maintain this safe distance in between the object and dependency from this object. The same, for example, happens. People ask me, Polina, do I need a very special amulet in order to play the game? Because you have to bring, I don't know, something in order to move yourself through this board, right? And I can lie saying, oh yes, it should be something very important to you, very high, a certain conceptual weight. But on the other hand, I can say, no, if you forget this amulet, it's not a problem. You can take a coin, you can take your ring, whatever, because it is in the moment when you give the power to an object, and it makes us really independent from that. Mm-hmm. So answering your question, I would love other people to use it as a tool, but not to be dependent on that. It may happen, as it happened to me, for example, with runes or tarot cards. But if we compare them in order to play this game, you need to spend several hours. You have to sit and dedicate time to that. So I think that in this case, this game is not that available for people who want to have a very short, quick answer. It's not like a spiritual McDonald's. It's not going to function.
It's not like a card.
So Well,
real quick, I mean, as far as, you know, so going back to rehearsal, I mean, that I think that's the thing with tabletop games in general. It is a story as old as time, is people gather around or an individual and tell stories. That's the thing, is telling stories. And that's the rehearsal. That's how you prepare yourself for whatever's in your future, is that you're just, you play pretend, and then maybe you learn something that helps you out, you know, on down the road. Anyways, that's my opinion.
What's What's the most uncomfortable truth the game has shown you?
That's a private question.
Okay, the most common truth then.
Oh, my light. Sorry.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, something happened. Just a second. I'm going to think it out. My darkness, as I see. Is it okay to be with this light?
We're good. Okay. We're good. Let's keep going.
Yeah, we're good.
Yeah, we're good.
Perfect. Yeah. Perfect. So I think that my relationship with my father, because it was difficult for me to handle all these situations with my father and therefore with God. Because while we are speaking about Abrahamic religions, even if we are atheists, but we were born and we were raised inside of these Abrahamic cultures, and we say Godfather. And every single time when we exclude our father from our life, from our decision-making process, we exclude as well God. So I think that this game helped me to restore in certain way my relationship with father and thus with God, and thus restore this trust towards the outer world that I'm not alone and there is something happening which might take care of me, to say that. So it was really important to feel safe, to restore this feeling of safety in this world that I'm taking care of from above and that I'm not alone. Because while you're being alone, you can take the burden of control of all the decisions onto your shoulders, and it might be really, really difficult to live with all this burden, right? And so, I think that was the most important thing. That it wasn't from one game. It was from a series of games that I started to understand that it is like this, like that, and that my father was connected to my relationship with the Supreme, because it might be God, universe, whatever. Obviously, cybernetics says that we don't have God. And if we remember the Tao of physics, right, this famous book, we can speak a little bit more about if there is one God, if it's all about my spirit. But yeah, that was the thing that at first I discovered. And then later I moved to another philosophical reflections about the Supreme.
That's fascinating. It's been a journey for you.
Yeah. You talk about once when after a death in the family, or maybe it was your boyfriend, that you'd spoken with, I think it was a priest, and you ended up getting in an argument with him because you told him that while you're studying Buddhism and other religions, and he didn't seem to think you should move in that direction, but you kind of stood up for yourself.
Well, thank you for being so attentive while reading my book. nobody asked me about that, so yeah, I'm so grateful for being a sonny. Yes, I was shocked because my father took me to this priest knowing that I'm in this difficult situation and I'm suffering and I'm experimenting all these uncomfortable emotions. And I got used to going to the church because my grandmother taught me that. And for example, in school, I had these dialogues with God, going to church, not because of rituals, because I did not believe in this ritualistic part, but it was my space in order to speak about what is going on in my life, what is going in between my parents and my family. So I had this habit to go into the church. So that's why it was not a surprise for me that my father took me there, and I was open. That's why I didn't have any bad thought of sharing or that I had to limit myself while sharing. I was sincere. And while being sincere, I was so shocked that he started to reproach me for that. And I got mad. I know that I have to. At that time, I didn't have lots of patience and maybe I lacked compassion. But I was so shocked because I was sharing something very profound, and it was a discovery for me, and it really helped me. And I thought that we can interchange our philosophical ideas about death, what I learned, and what I heard was a reproach. So yeah, I got mad. That's so true. And I was so mad that I did not come back to church for 15 years. For 15 wow. years. Maybe only last year, maybe last year or 2 years ago, for the first time I entered the church, because I felt that I really liked the environment, and maybe I wanted to stay there, not because of religion or Christianity, or it doesn't matter for me, but I miss this environment of thinking, right, of going to the house of God. But yes, I got really mad, and for 15 years I said that, no, I will never visit your house because I'm going to speak to God from my own house. I don't need any kind of mediator.
What sign are you?
I'm Leo with ascendant in Scorpio.
Oh, really? Okay. What's your moon?
That's why Scorpio just got all these death experiences and all these internal discoveries, and yeah.
What's your moon sign?
I think that's private information. I cannot say too much.
Okay. The Scorpio and the Leo, that's good.
So that's have you worked with other people with this game, and in other words, acted as a guide or an interpreter, a mediator, to help them in their lives? Have you played that role with people?
Yeah, sure. Because I work as a therapist with lots of people, with, like, I would use this adjective, as common people, and with activists and people who devote their life to the society aspects. And we played this game with different issues and different problems. And I truly believe that if we have to approach to traumatic experiences or some things that you are ashamed of, or you're lost, puzzled, it is a beautiful way in order to find a way to approach all the things that sometimes might be pretty difficult and your psyche starts to resist. So yeah, speaking about this potential place, it's a beautiful way, it's a beautiful tool. And I have been working with people for about 8 years now using this game. And that's why my book is a result of working with people, not only the result of working with myself, but also with people. And we create retreats while we have yoga practice, other chants practices, also working with this game. So yeah, and I truly believe that that's a very interesting mechanism, how you can work solely, individually, because I can work individually with people, but on the other hand, we can do it collectively, right? So while we are doing it collectively, that's pretty magical, because sometimes it really works as constellations. What do I mean while working as constellations? It's when we are being reflected in other people, and sometimes people say, oh my God, I worked so much. Because not only I found my traumas while you were speaking to me, while you were working with me directly, but also I was reflected in other people's experiences and while listening to other people. Actually, we did a small show, you know, with this game recently in Mexico City, when I worked with 30 people simultaneously. And that was amazing, because some people didn't want to come on stage speaking about their problems, and others were more courageous to say that, were more brave, and it worked perfectly, because we had this chance to throw a die, to work with archetypes. I also use psychodrama practices while we start not only to speak rationally about each square, but also in order to take it to the irrational and the emotional part. So sometimes I use some practices from psychodrama.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I thought I heard a knock. I thought I didn't know, was it the window or the door or what? Maybe it was just a spirit. I don't know. You did that.
So you're using the game with people that to help them with anxiety disorders and depression and stress and relationship issues, self-esteem. And so sometimes they can't move ahead in the game until they face some of these issues. Is that your experience?
Yeah, it's true, because sometimes they enter a pattern and they cannot come out of this pattern. That's why, for example, inside of this book, I created a series of exercises that you can do. If you landed on this square, I invite people to do these exercises because they provoke even more profound reflections. Because sometimes we read and we say, okay, it rings a bell, but you don't start to apply it to your own living experience. And that's why it was my idea, because all these exercises initially I created for me, because I was investigating all these emotional states, experimental states in different psychological, spiritual doctrines. And then I developed these exercises for me because I understood that I have to dig deeper than I'm doing right now. So that's why these exercises help to get out of these patterns. They help to understand that, okay, right now I worked that out and I feel that I can fly away from this square, for example. I remember that once I had a session with a person who I don't remember exactly in what pattern he was, but he finished on anger square or something, or maybe jealousy square, and he could not get rid of this square every single time. He was coming back to that, and he annoyed so much he decided to stop the game. And in 2 weeks he came back saying that, Polina, I cannot take this emotion, take this feeling from my life. I have to do something. And we started to play the game again, and managed to change and understand why he could not get rid of this feeling. And that was interesting, how the game accompanied his living experience in the life, how this emotion continued into his life.
Have you done this? You've done this in Mexico, right?
I did it in Russia, in Mexico, in the United States, in Argentina, in Italy as well, because sometimes we travel and work, yeah, with people all around the world.
Well, that's interesting. So, I mean, people do, regardless of what country or culture you're from, there is a common thing that Jung talked about, the archetypes, the symbols.
That's pretty cool. I really love the author, whose name is Stefan Zweig. I love to read him. And he said that people just change costumes around the history. Epochs change costumes, but the archetypes stay the same. So obviously we have these cultural aspects and our habits are different, what we eat, maybe how we react sometimes. But the archetypes, they are same. I have never, how we experiment sadness, frustration, betrayals, happiness, mostly they are the same. And while we're working with people, I see that sometimes the problems may be different from one country to another in the percentage. For example, while we're speaking about violations or some abuses, or I can say, like, for example, it happens more in this or that country, but I have not attended so much people so that to make this sociological research, right? But I attended some people, right? So that to say that this country, in my opinion, in the amount of people that I assisted to, may have this inclination. And that's interesting, while we go from individual things to collective things, because while we're going from individual to collective things, we can also speak about history and some traumas that happen because of historical consequences. For example, the war, the scarcity, hunger, and all the aspects that accompanied the existence of our ancestors.
Well,
the migration as well. Mm-hmm.
Do you work with groups or is it always one-on-one? You do work with groups.
Yeah. I work with groups. As I mentioned, that's, it may happen like in constellation when they are reflecting.
Right.
Recently, we did a show, and I hope that we can do the show as well in the United States at some point, because it works brilliantly. Some people are ashamed of speaking about their experience. And when they see reflected themselves in other people and what they are saying, they're like, oh, my God, I discovered something interesting about me and I don't have to share it because I feel that I feel ashamed. And I think that I feel ashamed. It's a very common feeling in people, because while living inside of these capitalistic bubbles, psychological bubbles, every single time when a problem comes to us, we feel that we are alone and we are the only ones who are experimenting, and the others are really good. They don't have any other problem. But yes, when we say, I feel reflected in this person, I feel the same, we get so surprised. And actually, our NGO, it is called The World Hurts. And when we communicate the name of our organization, people say, I feel the same. I feel the same. Oh, right now I'm not that alone. The world really hurts to me. It's also like naming the feeling, this new feeling that appeared recently, and finding this belonging in other people, like resonating with the pain of other, sometimes might be also a kind of a very profound treatment.
Just real quick, as far as sharing your book with folks and stuff, are you aware of Gen Con in Indianapolis, Indiana? It's a huge actually board gaming convention. It's by most accounts the biggest one in the world, and I bet you they would love to have you as a panelist at that. Yeah, so yeah,
that'd be interesting.
But she's in Argentina. We got to get you to the States.
Gen Con, GenCon, Gen Con. Yeah, yeah. Take a look. Yeah. Yeah.
So,
could you make me an introduction to her?
I will send you some links. All right. Yeah.
Okay.
That would be great, John. Yeah.
So, Paulina, the book is really an oracle. And for you, what's the difference between therapy and oracle work?
I think that's
pretty close.
It's all about it's all about verbal conceptualization, right? Because while we are speaking about therapy, we speak about some classical treatments, right? Some people say, oh, oracles, it's all about mystery. I don't want to do anything. I don't want to approach to mystical things because they are not rational, right? And people, they say it's not serious to play the game. And obviously, when we take, for example, a man, a mathematician who is 40, is he going to play the game? It's not serious, right? So in this case, we wouldn't say that that's an oracle. We would say that's a therapeutic experience. But basically, it's all about the name. You don't need anything in order to work with a person. You don't need a board. You don't need tarot card. You need your intuition. You need your experience in order to work with a person. And then the rest is just, I don't know, how you wrap it, basically.
She'd be great at this convention, John. You got to send her all the links.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, Gen Con, Dragon Con, there is a space for this kind of conversation at a traditional board game or, you know, tabletop gaming convention. It fits.
Paulina, what's your next book going to be? It seems to me you've accomplished a lot here with this book.
Right now I'm writing a fiction book.
Okay.
And, I'm inspired by Well, that's a small secret of my ego that I will share. I think that I haven't shared it with anybody, even with my husband. I didn't share that. But in our traditions, the editorial house that published my book, they also had connection at some time with Olympia Press. And Olympia Press was the editorial house that published for the first time Nabokov book, which is Lolita in the United States. Uh-huh. And it was so good for me to know that I'm like not that well from Nabokov. Obviously, I'm not comparing myself. He is a great artist and writer and author that I adore. But he inspired me truly to believe in the capacity of writing a book, because writing a book and believing that you can write a book, it's not that easy. And writing a nonfiction book, for me, it's easier because I have already written my PhD research, for example, right? So your research and your writing, and next challenge for me to write something that did not exist, does not exist. And you have to create this world. And that's why, yeah, I'm writing right now a fiction book. And I don't know what would be the results. Obviously, I'm not comparing it. I'm not even about to compete with Nabokov. But he inspired me. He was my inspiration here. And I would love to take this challenge.
Oh, that'd be great.
Oh, good luck with that.
Yeah, good luck with it.
With your fiction.
And please come back on our podcast. I love talking to you.
So you're... when people buy your book, they're not getting the board. They have to buy the board separately. So,
No. The book comes with a board.
Oh, it
you
does.
You have your own dice, but the book comes with a board. Actually, at the end of the book, you have the board that we designed. So,
Okay. Does it have pieces that you move then too? Or do you have to make your own pieces?
No, because we spoke about that you have to have your amulet. You can take your pen, pencil, whatever, to give the power to that, and that's it. And move it around the
world. Yeah, I got the book here up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, that's interesting. All right. Well, it's great having you.
Wow, that's wonderful.
John, can you put up a picture of her book again?
I got to unmute. Sorry, okay. There's a European board game, huge, next to Gen Con. The other big one is Spiel Essen, and I think that's in a European, big European board game convention. But yes, we will promote. That is something we want to do is, here it is.
Okay. The cover. Okay. There it is.
Includes game board. See?
Yeah. It does include the game board. Oh, I see. It says right on the cover. Yeah. I didn't see that. Yeah. Great. Okay. Great having you here.
Yeah, it really is. I'll send you the link when John puts it up, and John, when's it going up?
That will be in a couple of weeks. We'll definitely communicate that. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Polina. This has just been so fascinating.
Thank you too, and thank you for being so attentive while reading a book. Thank you for interesting questions, because I felt that you were really interested, because it doesn't happen every single time. So. Right now people are struggling with paying attention, with reading books, and sometimes we are more likely to speak rather than to listen to other people. So I'm so grateful for your attention and for the invitation. So yeah, thank you. You're amazing people to talk to and to have these kind of conversations. So thanks a lot.
Yeah,
you really created something unique, that's for sure.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
All right.
Great. Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Be in touch.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Bye. Have a nice evening.
You too.
You too.
Thanks for joining The Mystical Underground. Visit www.themysticalunderground.com for the latest blog post and book info. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or your favorite podcast app. Listen to the podcast at podcast.themysticalunderground.com. Follow Trish and Rob on Instagram at Trish and Rob McGregor. Follow us on Twitter at The Mystic Cast. Send email to podcast@themysticalunderground.com. And until next week, thank you for listening and stay mystical.